Hey, everybody, this is Jeff Peterson, and this is the Interstate of Music Podcast. And with me today, I've got a very, very special guest, a friend of mine that I've known for years, and I've gotten a chance to know a little bit about his past, but I want to share what he's all about and what he's doing. He is with MXL Microphones. He's the sales guy, the national guy. He's the guy that kind of helps product development. He's kind of the do-it-all within MXL and a go-to, and he's been a go-to for me as far as any sound questions because he's also a sound engineer, and I want to bring him to the podcast. Welcome, Trevor Fidel, MXL Microphones. Welcome to the Interstate of Music Podcast.
Ooh, thanks for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
That's awesome. So first of all, what was your early passion that got you into audio? Like, why audio as something you turned into a career?
I started, most people in audio, we start by playing music. So I got lucky enough to be bit with the drum bug, and I started playing drums when I was, I think, around like 8 years old. I got my first drum kit. My father's like a, I guess, recreational musician. He's a hobbyist. He plays out more than me now. Awesome. So we always had like musicians.
Is he a drummer?
No, he's a bass player.
Well, yeah. He's way smarter than you in the sense that when you say lucky that you got bit by the drum bug, I've never considered a drummer lucky in the sense that they've got the most gear to haul. Every gig you go to thinks you're playing too loud. Can you hit it less hard? You know, the struggle of being a drummer that wants to be what a drummer wants to be. It's hard to be that as a musician, is it not?
No, it's terrible at times. I think the worst thing is when you're, I'll give credit where credit's due. My dad really tried. He bought me a guitar first and was like, hey, I remember like 7 years old. He's like, you don't want to do this. And I'm like, I really want to play drums. He's like, it's a terrible idea. But it really sinks in when you spend like 4 or 5 years, you're really grinding everything out. And then like your friends come over and they're like, oh man, you play the drums. Let's hear you play. And like at a campfire, like everyone plays guitar and sings and has fun. No one sits around and watches you play drums alone.
No, and you don't happen to have a cajon sitting in the trunk of your car that you can bring out to the campsite because at some point the cajon probably ends up in the fire because you ran out of wood. So there's nothing good that can come of this.
it's just furniture, honestly. So all that happened. I love playing drums. All that. It's not bad. But I really early on, I remember just like turning to my dad and I was like, hey, if I buy this and this, can I record my band? And he was like, you can, but you know, you're not going to buy those. And he takes this tape deck out of the garage, slaps it on. He's like, you're going to learn how to use this. So middle school playing in a band, and I full on learned how to use a Sansui tape deck and like an old, like, this wasn't like, it's not like, oh, I had a Neve console. No, I had like Radio Shack gear and learned how to do it.
Was it one of those things where you did it because you didn't have a choice? What was your other option other than just learning how to figure out how to record yourself? And then as you start to record, just more or less like, oh, that sounded like crap. Like, we should have done this different or put it in this place. Was it just a lot of that early on?
Yeah, it was because So a typical trajectory as a musician, I think you have your guitarists, singers, piano players who get so encompassed in writing music. And as a drummer, I from an early age, I was like, I'm a hired gun. You know, I'm not going to write a song. I play drums. I do that and I love it. And I'm very technical. So I'm going to take my brain power when I'm not doing that. And Friday nights in high school, play around with microphones. And you know, like when my parents would leave town, it wasn't like, let's have a party. I'd call a few friends over and be like, yo, let's put amps everywhere in the house and make an album.
Yeah, it's something that I think people don't really realize what the challenge is. You can pick up an instrument and you can learn the instrument, but where it goes from there, it starts taking on a mind of its own because you're going to want to do your own recording. You're going to want to try to figure out how to video yourself in some way so that you can see what you're doing right, what you look like when you're doing it. Everything else starts to become part of it. And then when you become like a legit band, I mean, you want to start playing out. So,
yeah.
And then when you start to play out, that becomes like a big part. The audio aspect is a massive part of what you have to dial in, whether you're going to a place that supplies sound or you're hiring somebody to do sound. But I mean, a lot of places early on, they don't have their own sound.
No, right. And they, I mean, I'm dating myself for the first time, I feel like. But even when I was starting out in bands, like, we weren't posting videos on TikTok and Instagram and YouTube even. We, our only way of conveying what we did, like an EPK, which even sounds archaic now, was like we would make a MySpace page and upload this like MP3 and hope to God that it sounded decent. Meanwhile, like looking back, it probably sounded terrible, but like that was the pinnacle. It was like, how can we as 14-year-olds take, you know, this cover of You Shook Me All Night Long and record it and then upload it to our MySpace? And that was
MySpace.
Like, yeah, awesome. That was That's it. Awesome.
So what was your first gig? Like legit, that you felt was legit?
Playing or engineering?
Playing,
this is great. It was a hookah bar.
How old were you playing for this gig?
I was in eighth grade at a hookah lounge. And it was like totally like, you know, some nice family from the Middle East owned it. It was in New Jersey in a place called Morristown. I don't remember the name, but like you walk in and there's like rugs on the walls and everything. Here come all our friends. My parents are coming in and like there's just people smoking hookah everywhere. And I think all they served was like hummus and it was like bring your own wine. So it was like the weirdest thing.
So what did your set list have in it for this hookah experience? I mean, you shook me all night long. Necessarily feel like that's like hookah friendly. Like what is going on right now?
I'm going to accurately say there was probably at least two AC/DC covers. We were dead set on being able to play Stairway to Heaven front to back. So definitely played that and probably like a few really bizarre, like Avenged Sevenfold ripoff originals. So it was like the people who came to see us, I'm sure had a blast, but like if you were going out on a date, just like heard about this cool place, want some hummus and hookah, like we ruined your night. <I'm> sorry.
But I'll bet that was one gig with all the rugs all over the place that it wasn't as bad being a drummer.
And my setup was obnoxious. I mean, I had like, that was still at the peak. Like I mentioned, Avenged Sevenfold, like went through this phase where it was like the more tom-toms and cymbals, the better. So like,
it was trying to be like the Rush drummer, you know, setup where if I want to have to spin all around you, hit everything all over the place, arms flailing like animal. You know, those, it's crazy that, you know, you go back and you look at some of those moments in what you've kind of turned into and it's, you know, it's like, man, I, you know, for me to be doing that in eighth grade, kind of cool.
Oh yeah. We convinced some people to book us at their restaurant. Like,
yeah, that's crazy.
As crazy as it was, for some reason, they found us appealing and we did. And then it's definitely like a rite of passage. You're like, okay, we did this. It was a bit crazy. Probably not going to play there again. Let's figure out how we really move forward.
So that kind of gets you up and through the, you know, that high school kind of years. Obviously everything's just kind of getting a little bit better. You're getting a little bit better as a musician, getting a little bit better at managing your own sound. But at what point did a career path of getting into audio step in for you? I mean, was it just like, I hate chemistry and I don't want to do public speak? Like what made you, through the curriculum of high school and what your passions were, what made you think that this was like audio was something you wanted to go to school for?
So we had, my high school was lucky enough, we had an audio technology program. And it was it was pretty cool.
That is not common.
No. So we had that. I took that my freshman year of high school. You got like one elective, you know, so everybody was like, I'm going to learn auto shop or like wood shop. I was like, nope, going to play with microphones. And our teacher, he ended up definitely becoming like a mentor of mine. And he still teaches the program. I drop by here and there, help him out, get him free stuff when he needs it.
Yeah.
But he took a really grassroots approach and was like, you know, clearly he could just set us free and we all could make music, but he's like, you guys are going to learn every bit of how a microphone works. We learned MIDI the old way. MIDI now, you just plug in a USB keyboard and you play, but he made us learn the old MIDI channels, you know, like channels 1 through 15 are these kinds of sounds. But what was hidden in there that I don't think any of us ever realized was building up these really intense troubleshooting skills. So like he would set us free, tell us to go do something with a MIDI keyboard and no one would know how to do it or set it up right. But by the end of the year, you learned how to troubleshoot. And anything technology related, it's really, you know, that's your limitation. Like how long are you going to sit there to figure out the problem?
Right.
So that was cool. I kind of got that baseline. I got involved with doing like light and sound.
Sure.
That's cool too. And then I really liked it all. And then by my junior year in high school, I got dead set on, like, I'd worked a few odd jobs, but I was like, I really want to find an internship. And I was like, you know, if I have to go on Warp Tour and move amps around, I'll do that. But there was a local studio in town or two towns over that had a rehearsal studio too.
Okay.
And I ended up helping out there and I would be the guy who would go in and, you know, before the local band would come in to rehearse, I would turn the PA on and check the mics, make sure the cables were clean. But I was okay with just like hanging around late at night for the recording sessions. So I'd get to kind of sit on the wall, do that. We also, the studio closed, unfortunately, but they were definitely ahead of their time because we had the studio aspect, but they offered showcases for bands. So we would bring in a band, film them and record them and have a live show. And they would leave with a video, with a recording and have just had a show for their friends. So those on the weekends would be like all hands on deck. So while it wasn't, you know, I wasn't in, you know, Studio A at the biggest studio in New York, I was very hands-on at this place. Again, troubleshooting, figuring things out, rebuilding control rooms. We would repaint rooms. We'd turn a different room into a studio because of something. So it armed me by the time I got to my senior year in college of already having, probably being like 10 years ahead of where I should have been in audio.
Right.
Then like anyone, I was like, I'm going to go to college for this, you know, went through my whole, like, I don't even need to go to college for this, mom and dad, blah, blah, blah. They're like, yes, you do.
Yep.
But I got lucky enough to land at an audio program at Purchase College in New York. And from there I got set up with like an internship helping out a pretty well-respected engineer, Todd Whitelock, who took me under his wing. Our first session, again, I was just supposed to be a fly on the wall. The session went till 3 a.m. and my car got broken into.
Oh, geez.
And I was parked outside his house. So he drives me home. He gave me gas money and stuff and it was cool. But we pull up and my car's been broken into.
Did you even have anything worth anything in the car at that point?
So I had a vintage Slingerland drum kit in the car.
Oh, shit.
I had keyboards, amps, and they took none of it. It was just someone
really
took none of it. I don't think I even told anyone like how much I had in my car, but I probably had like $3,000 worth of gear.
Oh my gosh, that is lucky, man. So broken glass and you get through it, not bad.
Yeah, but he taped me up and I showed up the next morning at 7 a.m and was like, are we going back? And that I think proved to him that I was like worthy of it. And I ended up being his full-time assistant for almost 6 years and, you know, got to work on albums that won Grammys, got to do all this crazy stuff, but it all came back to really being able to troubleshoot, you know, see something going wrong, jumping in saying, hey, don't worry about that. You know, you keep doing that. I'll figure this out. I'll take, you know, the computer apart or reinstall software. And we also, I kind of carved out my own place as being like the computer whiz, and I could edit really fast and I knew every shortcut known to man. So like, I think we even, we had a few out. I mean, we always had albums that would be over budget and the timeline would be crunching in, but it got to the point where they could send me off into another room with the artist, do all the editing. He'd be in the room mixing, yep, and we'd just be assembly lining it.
So I'm gonna jump from a comment you made, you know, briefly, and you talk about, you know, being part of, you know, Grammy award winning albums and this and that. That is a career in and of itself for sound engineers in that, yeah, in that world. That is either like, okay, now I can make the next step with my career in this career path, or it's solidifying you in the position that you're in being a sound engineer, and it just elevates you to get more of that work at a higher level. But you're not technically right now a sound engineer.
No.
So what happened to the point of like, this is what I want to do for a living, this is my career, and then you start having this, that type of success being part of it. That's what sucks people in. It's like if you're a golfer and you're triple bogey on 17 holes and then you par the last hole, that's what keeps you coming back. So when you're having those flavors of success, what made you turn into, I'm going to make the sound part a career path in the manufacturing side and being part of that? Like, how did that turn for you? Why?
The technical term for it is OCD. Okay. But yep. I was always dead set on also how am I, because I'd be in all these situations, I'd be like, how am I going to make a living doing this? You know, how, and you know, you hang around anyone in the music industry long enough and they're going to tell you, don't do this.
Right.
And I loved what I still love what I'm doing. Like if I can go back to doing it all full time, I definitely would. But so in the middle of that, there was AES New York. This company Slate was looking for volunteers. And if you came and worked at their booth for 3 days, you got all their plugins for free. So okay. Saw it on Facebook, was like, hell yeah, yeah. I'll do that. Didn't think much of it, showed up and, you know, helped set up their booth. Just kind of just thought of it like a gig, you know, doing that. But they had this new touchscreen product there. And I think I was the most qualified audio engineer there.
Well, I mean, so, if you're talking about being the computer whiz and taking that niche, this kind of led into like you knowing what that product was that they were out there at that show doing.
Yeah. So I kind of became the like demo guy at that show because I was just all about it. I was like, I'm going to do these demos, you know, I'm going to start showing people how these things work. And I was pretty hands-on and like, you know, I also was very vocal about like, there were some things that needed to change about it. Cause I was like, look at me, I'm a sophomore in college. I definitely know what I'm doing.
Right.
I'm
for sure.
These,
yeah, you've never known more in your entire life, except for like your sophomore, junior year in college. And then when you're a senior and graduate, you realize, you know, when you're out there trying to find a job, how much everything you thought you knew, nobody cares about what you think you know.
Yep. Like if only you guys knew me when I was a sophomore.
Yeah. When I had all the experience that you're looking for, I lost everything. Now that I'm looking for a real job. Yeah, here I am.
Oh, man. But I decided then, again, like this crazy idea. I was like, you know what? I'm going to leave because it was like a 3 or 4 day thing. And like I knew Slate. I knew they were cool. They were in LA. Hadn't really, you know, had a cool, a few boring summers. I was like, you know what? I'm going to leave with an internship. And I ended up the last day, you know, taking everybody out. I knew where a good party was. I brought the whole team. And I was like, hey, I want to come out and intern with you guys in LA. And they're like, why would you want to do that? Gave them all the reasons. I was like, you know, you guys are a cool company. I think I could be helpful. And I was like, and I'm cheap, you know, just help me get out there, help me pay rent, things like that. Yeah. And they said yes. So my sophomore year, I did that. It was cool. Went to LA for 2 months. Had a blast. Kind of became a jack of all trades there, because they were in startup mode, and I mean, there were these big touchscreen consoles, and every other day we had to deliver one to a studio for some demo or event.
So you're getting a chance to network, meet people, see what everybody else is doing, West Coast versus East Coast. You know,
got to meet everybody.
Yeah,
and really the year before, I had a really crappy internship where I got fired from it because it was a big studio, and I was like, this is going to be what's going to set me up. Cause I was still working with Todd, but I didn't have like a backbone at a studio, and I had this experience, and I ended up cleaning toilets for like 2 weeks. And then the owner of the studio asked me to go wax his boat one day that it was like 105 degrees. And I had already gone to West Marine like a couple of days before to buy him like rope for his boat. But I finally was like, I walked up to his office. I was like, I don't think I should be cleaning your boat. And he's like, then you should probably leave. And I was like, deuces.
Yeah, right. No kidding. Right. It's like, it's so common for internships to turn into gopher positions that don't really elevate either side. And, you know, so power to you for like actually standing up and saying, I'm not getting anything out of this. I can go get a job that pays more than this internship and actually get more out of a random job than waxing your boat.
Exactly. Well, cause I was turning down work with Todd, who I was working for, to go just, you know, do mixing gigs.
Right.
And I'd be like, yeah, sorry, I'm at the internship. You know, it's going to be worth it.
Right.
And it's like, nope, not waxing a boat today.
Yeah. No kidding. So I think
that left me wanting some more substance that probably led me to like thinking about looking at a company. Cause I still wasn't like someone who's like, I'm going to work in corporate America.
Right. But what's cool about the way you've kind of gotten yourself to where you are is you stayed within the industry.
Yeah, very much.
If you weren't in this industry, what do you think you would want to do? If you up and just flipped out of the industry, what would you do?
I don't know. I mean, now I would, because I do dabble more in like consumer electronics, more big tech, things like that. But I still, it brings me back to this passion for music, all that. And just like being, so many people in this industry, we're all just like geeks still. And all we're doing is building products that we want for ourselves.
And so everybody. I find that fascinating because you see so many people jumping from job to job, you know, they'll be there 2 years, they jump to another job, they jump to another job. And you start to look at some of these resumes that people have, and it doesn't necessarily hold any passion with why they made these moves. They just felt better title, more money, different company, experience, all that kind of thing, where, you know, your journey is very much passion driven. Even your internships, even the fact that you're like, no, I'm not going to wax the boat because this isn't an experience that's going to benefit me. It seems like you're true. Because when I ask that question, you're like, man, I don't know. Like, I don't think you think of it at all.
No, not at all. And it sets in sometimes because I think I started realizing it at trade shows. Because even at Slate, you know, when I first started there, everyone was an audio engineer. You know, down to, you know, the people in accounting, we all had like a music background. But as you grow, you hire people who aren't really in the industry, which is fine.
Yeah.
But it sinks in when you go to a trade show like NAMM and you work 12 hours. Everybody's exhausted. No one wants to see anything. And you end the day and you're like, oh, man, I didn't get to walk around the trade show floor and see what everyone else has.
Right.
And I'm like, am I like, wow, I'm a nerd. Like I love this stuff.
Yeah. And that is the crazy thing is, as you get into the music industry, there is this underlying, you know, fascination with what they're currently doing, but also what else is out there within the industry. It seems like this constant desire to learn and grow and educate yourself with everything that's going on, it doesn't seem to stop. There doesn't seem to be a settling in of a role at a company, because they're always trying to figure out, like, how do I keep myself excited within the industry, which is crazy. It's something that's unique.
It's so selfish in a sense, but everyone's just trying to, because at the end of the day, we're all musicians and can, like, you know, get in a room and play music and, like, geek out about something. It's not like, you know, when you look at, like, Formula One racing and everyone's like, who has the better engine? Don't come near us.
Right.
It's like, again, I want to see, like, I have gear from everybody. You know, and there's an excitement about it. And that's, even in my little, like, pea brain of a sophomore in college, when I was like, I know everything, after that internship, I was like, wow, I think I'm really passionate about making things for people and improving the consumer experience. Because I get so, like, one of my favorite brands in the world is Yeti, because somehow this company has made
took a damn cooler and made it better.
How many, I've so many cups from them, and, like, I get so excited, and then I register the product and they send me stickers 3 months later. And so I was like, hey, because, you know, by the time you're in college for music, you know, the world does a really good job of making you feel like you made a wrong decision.
Right.
When you go home and all your parents' friends are like, well, Trevor, what are you really going to do for a living?
Yep. And I think it's like this weird best kept secret by all of you in the industry that are musicians, that you're like, all right, here's the deal. We love to play music. We love the industry. How can we all figure out how to create this industry that helps pay our bills so we can stay in it? We can all geek out. We're all going to know each other. Some of us are going to bounce around from different companies, and we're going to stay friends, and we're going to stay connected, and none of us are going to hate each other, and it's going to be just fine, and it's going to be great. And then we can gig out and keep our passion and dream alive. And just don't tell anybody that this is how this is how we're going to do it. It's like this, it's this craziness of, because everybody I talk to is, they're just good people that want to keep their dream alive and their career alive and something that they want to do. I have yet to come across somebody at one of the manufacturers in this industry that are like, yeah, I'm kind of thinking about going into real estate. that's not a thing. Like, people aren't saying that, you know. It's so I think it's really cool about what's going on. So when it comes to cool, what keeps you interested in the mic side, like the MXL side of your life? Okay, so you've got this audio engineering, you've got everything going on. MXL is really becoming kind of finding their niche, their place in the industry. And where does that fit for you, being where MXL is positioned as far as who you are personally and what you love about what you're putting out there and what you're, you know, sharing with people?
My drive comes from, so once I made these realizations, like, okay, this is what I like, I had to get to a realization where I was like, I just went to school for music. I need to, you know, arm myself with some more knowledge. So I quickly, you know, after college, learned everything I could about inbound sales, everything I could about inbound marketing, everything I could about product management, down to, it was like right when Lynda became LinkedIn, and I like would watch Lynda videos on night on product management and all this. So a big thing that I always did was like, okay, how do I make sense of all this? Cause I can think of a product, I can show off a product, but how do I get that, like, business intelligence behind it?
Right.
So as I did that, I think it became, again, in like my OCD nature, when I go to new companies, especially being at small companies, like, you have the luxury of kind of just being a janitor. Like, you come in, you're like, okay, we can fix this, 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 and this.
Yep.
So I think that that becomes an obsession. And when you're like a total nerd like me, it's like, how do I make buying a Yeti, how do I make buying an MXL mic as seamless as buying a Yeti, or as seamless as ordering on Postmates?
How do you convince the consumer demand that your product is something that they have to have, even if they already have something that's doing the job for them? Because microphones last, you know, like they last years and years. So how do you like get a consumer to think that they need to swap it out or switch to something that's yours versus what they're using, or use it in a different way, or you need this add-on feature, which is where Yeti kind of took it to that next step. It's like, oh, you've got an Igloo cooler, but you don't understand. You need ice to last for a month. Like, it's they've got us convinced that you have to have the stuff that you put in that water bottle be cold for 12 hours. Like they've got us convinced. They have us convinced.
I go hiking like twice a year, so I don't need this stuff.
You just simply don't. Why would you put so much fluid into something that's going to weigh that much, that's bulkier to carry around, because it's going to keep it cold? What in the hell? They've got us convinced. It's now we've got, you know, Amazon convinced us that everything needs to show up within 2 days to our doorstep. Yeah. You know, now it's like same day. Like the marketing strategies behind the variety of companies, the variety of platforms, and what's going on out there, I think is where, you know, the big question is like, is that the way you're looking at Yeti? That makes sense to me of why you'd want to bring that style, that philosophy, that consumer drive and need of a product into an MXL category.
Yeah. And that's where, so like one of the biggest differences, Yeti is a technology company of their own, right? Everyone is. But when you're working with, I'd call it that like next, like we're not quite consumer technology. We're not, you know, a pair of AirPods or something like that.
Sure.
But when you're working with that next level thing where it does take a little bit of extra knowledge, there's that challenge of how do I, and everyone's experienced this with a camera. It's easier to kind of talk about then, because everyone gets a nice DSLR, you go on your first vacation, you take a picture, still looks like crap.
Yep.
So it's like, how do I bridge that gap? And that's the drive for me that keeps it going, is we're problem solving. And at a company like MXL, or even when I was at Slate, it was all about how do we make this so easy for newbies, but not put a professional in an area where they're like, oof, like I don't want to go near that. That's too, that's kindergarten.
Right.
And there's
so bridging that gap of quality to user friendly, and hitting a price point that is friendly. You know, I mean, you've got price points that are all over the board. You've got very reasonable price points on very good equipment. But you know, sometimes you've got a marketplace that says, oh, that's $99. You know, it can't be as good as my $349. And it starts to get to the point, it's like, well, you're $349. Yes. It might have this feature, that feature, this level of quality that is the reason why there's a price difference. But who's using it, and what are they putting out for the level of quality that it needs to be? We talk about that with video technology now. It's like, if you're going to go to the social media platform, what level camera do you actually need? You just need what that platform is going to allow you to put out as far as the specs of video. Mm-hmm. So
that's the obsession in music production too, is we would, I mean, the easiest way, because I used to work on film scores and stuff too, is we would spend 4 days in New York in Avatar A with these beautiful audio setups that people would drool over, and we'd have the best orchestra in town and all this, all for somebody to watch it out of a sound bar.
Right.
And it's, that's for me what drove some of like everything was just a fear basis, because I was really the last generation of still being in real studios.
Yep.
And I never in my career have I been paid to work on tape. And that's even shocking. And that was a big transition. But, you know, there was a part of me that was like, wow, I don't even write my own music. You know, do I really want to hedge everything on just recording for people when everyone's learning how to record themselves?
And so do you find that the capability that is out there, the equipment / the softwares and the ability for musicians to self-record at a high level, do you think that's a positive of where the industry is going? Or do you find it as a negative because of some of that collaboration, creativity, and, you know, that teamwork of that process is being lost? Or do you think it's great, it's fine, and that's where we're going?
I think it goes in waves. Personally, and I may be wrong, but especially when I was coming out of college, I had a brief stint touring with some bands and things, and, you know, people are still in the studio, but that's when people, I feel like the whole idea of like making beats and producing electronic music really was like taking the world by storm, and places like SoundCloud and Bandcamp were like oversaturated. Everybody was a techno producer or a techno DJ.
Right.
And now, I mean, if you look at like modern music now, you look at like someone like Billie Eilish or someone, they have taken that DIY approach, but the music that's coming out of there is more substantial.
Absolutely.
So I feel like we almost have to hit that oversaturation point where everybody is doing this one thing for someone to say, okay, maybe I should be using a guitar again, or maybe I should be using this. And I think in music, we're kind of in that because, as you know, like the idea of like a garage band has gone away,
right?
Essentially.
Right.
I think it will come back.
I think so too. I think it'll re-energize, you know, the next genres of music as far as that next sound. Because, you know, 80s music is hot right now. And so that, like, it's one of those things where I think it'll cycle back through where somebody's like, I want to be different. And different is just a few decades ago that it's now different again by playing it a certain way and a certain style. And, you know, it's those separation points. And I think we find that in everything that we do, whether it's, you know, my generation saying that the generation that's coming out of college, they didn't go through what I went through. They're not going to know this. They are. They're going to be just fine and figure it out. And they're way smarter than I was when I finished up school and hit the workforce, you know? So I think it's interesting of where people are, being given these tools. And I think it's really interesting as far as like how manufacturers are having to go at it so many different directions to reach those consumers and convince them into their gear, because you've got so many different types of musicians now because of what they're capable of doing.
And in our industry, you know, there are people who, because I think what you're alluding to a little too is like, a lot of people, it's easy to get mad about it. Like when I was, you know, going bar to bar, trying to make money with my band, packing up our stuff, and we saw kids just like popping beats out online. Like, we were like, that's stupid.
Right.
And real quickly you learn, like, you know, you're just, it's your perspective. You're just getting mad because you don't understand it. And it is essential to get to that next step. So on the manufacturer side, you know, I've seen people who almost are like, you know, it's like, oh, those dumb TikTokers or whatever. But like, you know,
that is how they are making it big.
Everything. So if you ignore it, great. But then whatever comes next, you're potentially harming that or even holding that back by not just fully jumping into what's going on now.
You've got to explore all of it. You've got to explore all of it. You've got to be part of it. You've got to understand it before you say no to it. I mean, it was funny. Even around here, everybody's like, you know, I'm like, we need to get a TikTok account set up. And everybody's like, really not a I mean, what would we do? What, how do we fit? And I'm like, I have no idea. I have no idea if it's going to work, not work, how we should use it as a tool, but we have to explore it. We have to try it. And it's okay if we put it out there and it's terrible, because nobody's going to judge you by like, oh, your TikTok channel's terrible.
Jeff tried. Like, that's so, but so, you've, I like, that's one thing that I really like about the stuff that you do is you do always seem to give things a chance. Even like over the pandemic, it was the, what's the app that everyone talks? The one that you, everyone gets up and talks on, like anyone can talk.
What was it? Clubhouse.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. You, cause everyone tried a Clubhouse too.
Yep.
In my humble opinion, I think it's kind of passed already.
It's gonzo. I don't even know if it is that even a thing. I mean, I've got a couple of rooms out there that have been vacant. So if somebody's looking to rent a room in Clubhouse, I've got a couple spaces they can have. Cheap. But you're on the cheap.
You're always open to that stuff. And it's very reminiscent of something Gary V always, I remember always seeing him talk about that. And specifically, I remember it was like 5 or 6 years ago, he was telling every single entrepreneur to make an Alexa skill. And like, he's like, if you don't make an Alexa skill right now, you are wasting your time. And it's not that everything's going to work or be perfect, but if you don't even, if you're not even open to give that a chance, you lost your seat at the table.
Our video content are the teams of people that were starting to think and try to figure out how to make TikTok work. The ideas that came outside of that and the thoughts and the creativity, the fun, the laughing, the like, that was awful. All of that was more important than if we had a TikTok work. It was also like what led into other thoughts, other ideas. What can we do better? And what I always love about some of those platforms is like, it's like, do it in 60 seconds.
Yeah.
Like how do you take something and make it entertaining, informative, important, funny enough in a time frame that they give you? That alone is like important enough to give some of this stuff a chance. It's like even Clubhouse during the pandemic and everything. What did that give you a chance to do? It gave you a chance to put yourself out there. Head up a group, improve your networking skills to try to draw attention to it. And through that process, whether Clubhouse exists anymore or doesn't, if anybody's even using it, but the people that you networked to during that time, you're still connected to and now are probably following other stuff that you're doing on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
So where is the downside? Yeah.
So the bigger madness is like, so something everyone always talks about with audio specifically is how technology now removed any limits. And part of why the music of the 70s and 80s was so great is because you were limited to tape. You were limited to this. You were limited to that. But now these platforms that are coming up now, TikTok, there's some magic to it. I don't know if it's 60 seconds, but you're limited. You can't like coordinate a whole set in Ableton and then dump it in TikTok. You have a limit. And I was even talking about this with my wife the other day, how we miss Vine, because Vine gave you a 7-second limit. And there was so much creativity that came out of that. Naysayers who were
it's that elevator pitch concept. It's like, if you only have this much time and this much attention from somebody, and our attention span is short. You know, so if you can't get a message across that's interesting enough, like what is that? Like going back to Yeti, man, we should get paid by Yeti for this podcast. But going back to that, they basically said, ice lasts for 6 years in our cooler. I mean, there's 7 seconds and you go, what? Like how, that's not possible. And then you look into it. So it's like those teasers that get you, grab you, and make you look into it for the amount of time you're willing to invest in figuring it out. And that's how some of these platforms are becoming more important of what we're doing. So as we kind of wrap things up here, MXL-wise, what do you feel is your Yeti cooler in the industry that you're just really excited about that's new, that might be coming, as far as where you're fitting into the market in the industry that you think is going to hit with a splash or should hit with a splash?
So we have two microphones, the Revelation 2 and the Revelation Mini FET, which are, to me, are Yeti coolers because yep. they're these super awesome mics that sound like some of those vintage mics that we love, and they're at a way better price point. However, still to this day, people are way more enthusiastic about our $99 mic, like the 990 yes. that's been around for 20 years. Right. There is nothing technologically exciting about it.
But it's a great mic.
Exactly. And that's where, so that's like, this is a whole like example of this entire conversation that we're driving to do more and more and more and more and more. But we also are respecting what the world's telling us, that people love these microphones that are inexpensive and just perform really well. And I got a call the other day from someone. They're like, I don't know how you guys do it and make something sound so good for this price.
I have used multiple microphones. During the pandemic, I was so sick and tired of dealing with Zoom calls with people with bad audio and everything. And we were all using laptop mics at that point. And I'm just like, I can't do this. So I literally invested in all of your Tempo USB, yeah. USB mics. And I sent them to everybody on the team. And I said, here's the deal. It's driving me crazy to listen to all of these other people with bad mics for these Zoom calls. This isn't going away anytime soon. We're stepping up our game. And I'll tell you what, I'm like, we're not going to be the ones that they're saying that about. It was that simple. And for the price point of that Tempo USB mic, for the quality of what it just turned into for our own meetings with each other, so worth the cost of admission into that. And yeah. such an easy travel, quick, like, hey, I'm going to jump on this call. I'm in a hotel room, boom. Or, hey, I'm going to do a quick podcast outside in the lobby for a trade show, and I want to yep. record it. It's just, there's such a convenience to those products. And you guys are doing a great job hitting the quality within the price points, but you're also, like you said, you're taking things to the next level and kind of driving the industry, or at least realizing within the industry what's necessary on that yeah. next level as well, which I think is great about what MXL is doing.
Yeah. It's, you know, I think we all have to put that effort in and push, but it's like the, you know, Costco still has to sell rotisserie chickens. You know, the 990 right. is still our rotisserie chicken.
Right, right. And knowing your niche, knowing your consumer, but still looking outside of your industry for those ideas and those marketing, you know, concepts and driving those things. And I think you guys are doing a great job, and you're heading that up at MXL. And I can't thank you enough for being part of the show here. And
yeah, thank you so much.
You know, it gives a chance for people to kind of grab onto and see what what gets you to where you are. The path within the industry is never the same from one person to the next. Mm-hmm. And thank you for sharing your story here for the podcast. And we'll catch up. You're part of the Interstate Music family, and yeah. I'm really excited about that. So thanks for being part of the show, and we'll talk soon, my friend.
All right. Thanks, Jeff. And thank you, everybody.
All right, Interstate Music. Here we are. This is the Interstate Music Podcast, and I am Peterson. And you know what I say at the end. Peterson out.